While I am setting up here, let me first make a correction to something I misspoke. Last time somebody asked me what the, I believe, five major points were that they put on our graphs, and we had considerable discussion about them. And I think I said water measures, they are OH measures. And I am going to read you the few sentences that we gave as justification for doing that. We've discussed it exhaustively. I don't mean to reopen the issue, but you will find out why we did what we did, and we'll leave it at that, and we can pick it up again if you want to at later times. Now, given that we went through only two of the 13 myths that I want to discuss, and I'm sure this audience will like this, I'm going to use superalphenic speeds today to go through the remaining ones. And because I'm sure we'll get nonlinear perturbations in the audience, you know at least as well as I do that those perturbations decay very rapidly, and I'm going to make sure that they will decay very rapidly, and we'll pick up the details of the questions later in the discussions we can have this afternoon. So let me read you first the few sentences that we gave as justifications there, and I'll go on. It may appear surprising at first sight that line widths of OH measures, which are neither massive clouds nor protostellar cores, would obey the relation 39, that's the analytical prediction from the 87 paper. However, it should be borne in mind that these objects are found in high-density regions of star-forming clouds. For such regions, the detailed numerical calculations described in sections 4 and 5, that's the paper, which follow the ambipolar diffusion-initiated protostar formation from densities of a few hundred to 10 to the 10 particles per cubic centimeter, invariably predict Milligauss fields at densities greater than about 10 to the 8 particles per cubic centimeter. In other words, the star formation process creates physical conditions of density and associated field strength that require only a pump for major action consistent with observations to take place. And I refer to a previous paper which we argued that point also. We expect equation 39, that's that equation, the prediction, to be valid for water measures as well, which are characterized by even higher densities, about 10 to the 10 particles per cubic centimeter, and stronger magnetic fields, almost 100 milligauss.
It's not a prediction,
though. You need to answer. That's fine. I'm not going to react to that. All right. This audience told me that I don't need to go through myth number three because everybody agrees.
You do, however, need to get screen.
My apologies. My apologies.
It will be faster.
Yeah, it would be a lot. It would be a lot faster than that. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. We lost it
again. No, wait again. Press it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, fine. You're fine.
Thank you. Okay, I am going to give you the reasoning here because, as I understand it, the reason that most of this audience disagrees, or agrees, I should say, with that this is a myth, is related to the dynamical timescale versus depletion timescale of clouds. Is that correct? I'll give you a very simple argument why this is cannot be right. We cannot form these clouds in 1 million years. The most efficient way to collect matter is in a three-dimensional sense, especially spherical accumulation of matter. So if you try to accumulate 10 to the 5 solar masses from the mean density of the interstellar medium, and I'm being generous because the people who want to do that start from intercloud densities that are 0.1, not one particle per cubic centimeter. In a million years, you need almost 100 kilometers per second to do that. and there are no observations that come close to seeing velocities. These are ordered velocities, focused velocities. These are not line waves, okay? So I made this argument. There was a member of the audience who said, wait a minute, you are missing a very important point, because the accumulation phase of molecular clouds is in atomic hydrogen form. So we want, he didn't use those terms, they want to hide it in atomic hydrogen. Well, when I was a graduate student, there was a bright radio observer lady at Berkeley by the name of Nanielle Dieder. And even at that time, in the early and mid-70s, they could observe column densities of atomic hydrogen smaller than 10 to the 19 particles per cubic centimeter. These are much bigger column densities here. You cannot hide it in atomic form, basically. That's what I'm saying. And if you consider the strength of the magnetic field in the general interstellar medium, they might have to do it in one-dimensional form. As somebody commented, Mestel considered this problem also. You would have to bring it from very far away, and the velocities then that you would need are 1,000 kilometers per second. Yes. There is no argument here. Is there? Okay, what is the...
Independent of this, yes. There is still an open problem of observing a cloud that is forming, no matter what is your perspective.
Oh, yes. Remember, I'm...
So there is a criticism that would apply to any model, because no matter what is your model for forming a cloud, nobody has observed a cloud that is being formed in one, with one model or the other.
Forgive me, I disagree with that, but this is not a part of my talk. We can take it up, and I want to go through the important things that are left here that this audience will be more interested here, and I'll be glad to address that issue in discussions. Myth number four, cloud statistics in the solar neighborhood, meaning that about 9 out of 10 clouds contain stars, so we have only 1 in 10 that doesn't have any stars, imply at least at first sight that the cloud ages are comparable with the star formation timescale. That argument has been made in print and promoted. If the people who want to promote that argument had written an equation down for the statistics that they want to use, they should have written down that the timescale for star formation divided by the age of the molecular cloud should be equal to the total number of clouds, NS stands for no stars, this is important, divided by the total number of clouds. Now, observations, they say, in the solar neighborhood, and I don't have a problem with that, give us the right-hand side to be 0.1. You have no choice. If you want the star formation timescale to be a million years, you solve this equation trivially and you find that the molecular cloud age should be 10 to the 7 years.
What's the definition of the star formation timescale here?
How long it takes to form stars from the...
The delay between cloud formation and the onset of stars.
Yeah, yes, thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. That's the question. That's, I have to stick with the way they define the quantities.
Right.
Okay? So the conclusion I want to draw here is not that stars cannot form in a million years or that clouds cannot have a different age than 10 to the 7 years. The conclusion is that you cannot have both of those. You cannot have very rapid star formation and very young molecular clouds. It's inconsistent. Myth number five, observed magnetic fields are too weak to support the observed molecular clouds. That is, molecular clouds are highly magnetically supercritical. Let's see what theory had taught us in the first place. The critical mass to flux ratio for a cloud as a whole, as we determined it with Spitzer back in 1976, it appears, by the way, to be a universal constant. In reality, it's not. It has a small dependence on how the mass is distributed in the flux tube of the system. And if I really wanted to be precise here, it's not important, it's not a big factor here to worry anybody in the audience, but if I wanted to be precise, this should be applied only to a distribution of mass in the flux tubes of a system that if you were to start, say, with an initially uniform magnetic field, the mass distribution would be that of an initially spherical cloud of uniform density. Doesn't mean the shape of the cloud is a sphere. The distribution of mass in those flux tubes would correspond to that. And then you can think the other extreme, the distribution to be a cylinder or a disk of uniform density, and you would find a slightly different factor, but it's not significant, so I'm not going to dwell on that. Now we can write this equation as we discussed yesterday afternoon in terms of the mass instead of the mass to flux ratio by eliminating the fluxes, you know, the story, right? B pi r square, eliminate the radius in favor of the density and the mass. You have mass on the left hand side, you have mass on the right hand side, solve for the mass, and you get this expression. So I normalized it to reasonable values, mean values in the interstellar medium. Somebody actually would say this is 6 here, so it's 2 to the third is another order of magnitude you would get here. But I want to be conservative. I don't want to overstate anything.
6 applies to density of about 50, so.
But you showed, though, that
probably right, more right for density of 1.
But Hylas's observations, as well as yours, show that if you were to plot log B against log N, there is a very extended density region that the magnetic field is constant. So it's not correct that there is a one-to-one correspondence. You can use, I'm using a small value to be conservative. It's not meant to push a particular idea or a value here. So the most useful way to look at it, a theorist looks at it this way, but if you're an observer, the most useful way to look at it is to say, look, I can measure densities and estimate masses a lot more easily than I can measure magnetic fields. So solve this equation for the magnetic field, and you'll get a value. What is that value? It's not the value required to support that mass at that density. It is the value of the magnetic field that if it were to be present in that cloud, it would never allow it to collapse under flux freezing, even if you flatten the cloud completely into an infinitesimally thin disk. It will support it in the lateral direction. And that's a useful way of looking at it. And I give an example here. One can look at any cloud and decide whether it's magnetically supported or not. We are stuck with this. We don't have any room to maneuver. There are different ways of writing that same equation. Again, more useful for observers probably than theorists, but let's do it anyhow. Because you have the mass to flux ratio being the column density pi r squared, the flux magnetic field pi r squared, the r's cancel, and we have mean column density in grams per square centimeter, magnetic field in Gauss, again given by that 1 over 63 g square root. Or if you really want to pursue it further, you get the number column density, and that subscript p is important because I use the number density of protons, which makes it unnecessary to distinguish between atomic and molecular clouds. It's defined in such a way that takes care of all of those things. All the gravitating mass, basically, is what it has to count here. And because there is a conversion factor between the column density and visual extinction, it's even more useful for observers to write it in this fashion. And I had given those expressions early on in a review paper. One can use whatever one desires for the particular purpose they want to study. Now, molecular clouds are supported by turbulent pressure.
Question. I didn't understand how you put that. It was me. You observed the formula for magnetic support.
I put values in there for any molecular cloud you want, the density and the mass, and see what magnetic field is observed there and see if it supports it. Take your favorite object.
I believe we had a talk about this yesterday, and the answer was it's marginal.
Yeah, it's very near critical. I don't want to reopen that.
There is no molecular cloud. You still mentioned mass of 10 to the 5. There is no observation that gives the mean field for the mass of 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6, or 9.
You choose your values from those formulas.
There is no observation that gives that.
There is no molecular mass observation of 10 to the 5. Could you give me what example you want me to consider as being non-magnetically supported, and we take it from that if you want to?
Ended up with 500 solar masses.
For a density of 1,000 parts, a unit though, a single unit, not a cloud complex. Yes.
There are data that could apply to that.
Sure. Well, yeah, and the data say it's marginal, in which case we conclude, you know, we can't really tell. It could go either way.
Or I will.
I mean, if we're a factor of 10 of the line.
If you are asking me what they.
If we're a factor of 2 of the line, and I don't believe the observation.
Let me address the question differently then to include the observational evidence in there. If you are asking me what the observations say about the actual mass to flux ratio of molecular clouds, cores, whatever, relative to the critical value, I'll say for cores, and Dick addressed that issue observationally, are shown to be somewhat supercritical, meaning a factor of 2, maybe even 3, and that's completely consistent with our calculations, and I'll show the figures. Dick showed one.
Sorry. They are also consistent with being exactly critical.
That's fine, but that's within our, and that molecular clouds as a whole, the envelopes, we have one cloud that I know, the Bernard 1 cloud, that there is an independent determination of the magnetic field in the envelope in there, although if you are a careful observer, you might say, but the beam may have been somewhat contaminated
The Bernard 1 cloud is not a giant molecular cloud. The Bernard 1 cloud is a little dinky thing.
Look, I have to take what is available observationally.
Sure, yeah.
When observers go and
we're not saying you're wrong, we're just saying you can't tell.
I didn't take it to be as an offense that I'm wrong.
Okay.
I am saying those are predictions. Okay, we are stuck with them. Go and put whatever values, if you're an observer, in there and see if clouds are magnetically supported.
We don't know the answer for giant molecular clouds.
I'm not agnostic.
I'm not saying I'm right or wrong. I'm saying we don't know the answer for giant molecular clouds. We can only know it indirectly. You have to do very complicated tests.
I am not an observer to go and measure it. I made a prediction, and I'm stuck with it, and I let the observers to go and determine whether I and my students, ex-students, whatever, are right. Okay? That's the point here.
Okay. I think we can probably go.
Oh, yes.
Prediction number 5, not meeting number 5.
Fine.
Enough, come on.
Paolo,
sorry.
Come on. All right?
Just let it go.
Here we go, myth number 6. Molecular clouds are now you will talk after this, all right? Are supported by turbulent pressure. So let's see what the turbulence calculations are doing, and then I'm going to issue a challenge here. Okay? Why do the turbulence calculations that are using highly superalphenic turbulence do not get those objects to go bazoom and collapse and probably, I'm only joking, okay, form massive black holes in there? Why don't they collapse as a whole? To my mind, there are two reasons, and prove me wrong if you want to. The first one is that the calculations are using periodic boundary conditions. That means that the only way that you, physical way, that would be reasonable is if you had mass surrounding your external to your computational region, gravitating mass that is pulling the object. That's the effect. Think in one dimension and you will find out that is the effect of that. You have external gravitating mass that is pulling the envelope of the cloud away. It reduces, in a sense, the effective gravitational field of the object you are modeling. As I said, we have to be able to have fun and joke and argue at the same time. It's as if you have Maxwell demons holding your boundary there in the envelope of the cloud and preventing from collapsing. And there is a second reason that it by itself can support, prevent the clouds from collapsing as a whole, is this copious injection of energy into the system at some power spectrum, but enough to replenish the rapid decay of the turbulence. Fine. So those are by the way, the first one is not realistic, but this one might turn out to be right.
In fact, something that addresses both of them, are you familiar with the work of
Nakamura? I'm sorry, what?
Something that addresses both of those points, are you familiar with the work of Nakamura and Lee?
Yes.
So they've done simulations where they have something, so they are using a periodic box, but it's much bigger than their cloud.
Yes.
So they have a centrally concentrated cloud. The energy injection is not by magic paddles, it's by protostellar outflows, which are modeled very simply, and certainly this can be done vastly better. But they have a cloud that does not, in fact, collapse into a massive black hole. It's not held up by periodic boundary conditions. It's held up by a physically reasonable model of protostellar feedback.
If you assume that you're providing sufficient energy to replenish the turbulence, of course you will support it.
But truthfully, that's a cluster, not a...
Thank you.
No, no, no.
Thank you.
It hasn't been done in GNC. I'm working on it.
Very good. Actually, we have something to say in print on that also, but not here. Let me come to readdress the question in different form and see if you will agree. Suppose we start with a cloud that has not yet given birth to stars. Because if we are going to have a theory of star formation, we've got to understand how the first stars in that present day, let's not even go to primordial, stars are going to form in that cloud. You definitely are not going to have internal sources of energy. So somehow stars will be able to form, and the cloud will live long enough for stars to form, and they are the first generation of a present-day star formation in a molecular cloud. Now, if some magic mechanism, I'm not going to bias anybody by suggesting my own, is able to form stars under those conditions, why would that mechanism not be able to compete with whatever other mechanism you want to suggest later? I dropped it. Nonlinear perturbation, is that right? Why would that mechanism not be able to operate later?
Okay. I'm confused. The mechanism will make, in a quiescent cloud, you know, that has no stars and no internal feedback, the mechanism that will make stars is gravity. So it'll make a few.
How did you support that cloud to get
Well, it was probably born turbulent, but suppose it weren't. Suppose it were quiescent. Suppose it were quiescent.
Yes, please.
Well, it wouldn't be supported for the first, you know, one-tenth of a crossing time.
Yes.
In that one-tenth of a crossing time, it would make a lot of stars, which would inject a lot of energy, then it would be supported.
Let's rephrase.
So it free falls for a short amount of time and then gets
Let's look at it a little more carefully. That would comply and would agree with the original suggestion by Hoyle that star formation forms in essentially free-falling clouds. Okay, that's the
only for the first tenth of a crossing time.
Well, let's pursue it, all right? Let's pursue it a little. How far do you want to how much do you want to increase the density? From what value to what value before you fragment it and form stars? Give me a number, and then I'll give you the answer.
Well, in the low-density parts of the cloud, almost none at all, because the free-fall time is very long. In the high-density parts of the cloud, clouds are...
We're talking about molecular clouds that are about to form stars. The first molecular clouds that are going to form stars. Give me some values so that I answer the question correctly, not sure waving our hands.
The PDF is wide, right?
Yeah, I mean, the PDF is wide. So, all right, so enough... So there's stuff which has a free-fall time of 100,000 years.
Okay.
So I want to make... You know, the first stars in 100,000 years. I'll make a cluster in 100,000 years.
What will prevent many parts of the cloud from essentially free-falling? They are going to free-fall.
Sure, they'll free-fall for 100,000 years, but the free-fall time in a molecular cloud is a few million years, and so they'll move about that far.
The free-fall of a molecular cloud is a million years, you said, because of the density.
At the mean density of molecular clouds, the free-fall time is a bit over a million years, so, and there's a little bit of mass for which the free-fall time is 100,000 years. That little bit of mass will form stars, and that'll support all the rest of it, which has a million-year free-fall.
There is an observational restriction. You have to be careful here. And the observational restriction is that the mean density of stellar clusters is comparable to the observed mean densities of molecular clouds today.
That is
a little less than 10 to the 4 particles per cubic centimeter. That is an old observation that has not been overturned. So the point I'm trying to make here is you better be able to fragment a molecular cloud by any means you want, by a density of about 10 to the 4. You have to start it in order to form stars. Otherwise, you will have very compact, I'm not saying star formation will not take place, you will get very compact clusters that will not agree with observations. In other words, if you take your idea of forming a cluster there and spread, destroy the stars and spread the mass uniformly in the region that the cluster occupies, you will find that it will be higher than the observed mean density of molecular clouds and the observed clusters.
Well,
it will be smaller.
That in some sense is the point of feedback. I mean, you're talking about the gas. I mean,
that's the second generation.
No, it's the first generation. The first generation will push the gas in the cluster away. I mean, so all you need to, I mean, why is your room at 68 degrees? There's a thermostat there, which is controlling. So all you need is that first generation of stars to form in 100,000 years, and you initiate the feedback.
If that first generation of stars formed because, for example, fragmentation by ambipolar diffusion, why would that mechanism not work later on?
I think it doesn't. it'll form faster without ampipolar diffusion. I mean, I what I'm suggesting, you don't need to explain why stars form. Gravity takes care of that.
I'm sorry, what?
You don't need to explain why the stars form.
Right. The question is just what happens as soon as they do. Do they
grow
fast enough, and then does that initiate a feedback that produces some kind of regulation of the star formation?
And I'd also point out your density of 10 to the 4 per cubic centimeter. That's if you smeared all the stars out.
Yes.
But we know that star clusters probably form with fairly low efficiencies. And so there's probably a factor
10%
of 10.
To 50%.
Right, and so you get a factor of 10 more density in gas.
But for the sake of the argument, we can actually take this challenge and ask the question, what will happen if there is no star? Because after all, in a molecular cloud, 10 to the 6 solar masses, it's possible that the feedback from the star is not the real answer, especially in clouds that haven't formed too many stars yet, say the Magdalena cloud. Unless you want to buy that, it has to be a very young cloud just formed, for example.
Well, I've no problem with that explanation for Magdalena's cloud, because there's only one of them in a galaxy.
It can be
the youngest one.
But let's say that there is no internal feedback, then I do agree that the second answer is correct. If you turn on one of our simulations without gravity, with subgravity, sooner or later, actually pretty soon, it's going to form a big clump. Everything is going to go into one big clump. That's all you're right. What I don't agree with is what you put in parentheses, because we know that this is scaling of velocity, the Larson derivation. So even if whatever is your favorite mechanism to provide it, if there is no internal energy mechanism, you know that there has to be some energy that provided from above.
Yeah. Very good.
Otherwise you couldn't maintain.
Very good.
So really the argument is, what is the origin of that energy from above? Right?
I intend to address that.
Okay.
Thank you for leading into that point. Suppose that you have external sources of turbulence that are going to replenish the decaying turbulence in a cloud now. I assume that this audience is well familiar with the notion that if you have a disturbance, wave or turbulence, that is going to propagate from the outside to the inside of the cloud, it transfers linear momentum inward in the cloud. So if that cloud in order for that cloud not to be able to have collapse on its dynamical timescale, it has to have already an internal source of support without that inflow of turbulence, because that will only compress the cloud. You need outgoing waves or turbulence to provide support for... I'm sorry, that's a basic mechanics argument.
It's not a simplified feature, it's incorrect. Because if you...
It's basic physics, it's not a simplified fiction.
No,
you need outgoing waves to get transfer of linear momentum outward to provide a force outward. The force is linear momentum...
It's not basic physics of supersonic turbulence. Supersonic turbulence, we have often, for example, a very dense region that is formed by compression, like you said.
Yes.
But there is so much shear in the high density region,
yes,
that it's not able to collapse, it's going to disperse.
Remember, you are trying to propagate from the outside. Take any shape. Make it one dimensional to understand it better.
You can't make it one dimensional. That's exactly the point.
Yeah.
That this is something that relies on the fact that there are multiple dimensions.
You're relying on big shocks, essentially.
Yeah.
Wait. Take a spherical cloud, then I don't really care. Is somebody here arguing the point, let me understand it correctly, that if you have a signal that will propagate the energy from the outside of the cloud of any shape towards the interior, that whatever mechanism it is propagating the signal, will not transfer linear momentum in the same direction? Is somebody saying that?
No.
Yes, it has a lot to do with anything. It doesn't depend on speed. It's a matter that the time rate of change of momentum is important.
I think there's some semantics here.
Please.
Would you like to please move on? Because we've been only
having
to get hungry.
Now, let's see what ampipolar diffusion can do to turbulence or hydromagnetic waves by itself. Suppose there is no other decaying mechanism. One can show very easily, and this is more than a 20-year-old argument, that if you put disturbances, weakness in the magnetic field lines, which supersonic turbulence will certainly put in there, you can calculate analytically and easily the time scale that ampipolar diffusion will kill those disturbances, and it depends on the wavelength of the perturbations you're putting in. Okay, it goes at the square of the wavelength. I normalize the expression to a typical strength of the magnetic field and a typical density of molecular clouds and a typical degree of ionization. if you take one parsec wavelength here in 10 to the 5 years, the 1D, because you have a magnetic field here, you can use 3D as a small difference factor, threefold time is longer. And the wavelengths that are relevant for the formation of molecular cloud cores, the typical scales that you need to consider, are closer to 0.1 parsecs, not 1 parsec. The time scale for the decay of those perturbations is only 1,000 years. So ambipolar diffusion alone is going to kill very rapidly the short wavelengths.
If you want to use lambda equals 0.1 parsecs, you need to use a bigger value of n and a bigger value of b.
No. The picture is mistaken. I have the molecular cloud that has not yet formed any fragments, and I'm whatever mechanism you want to use, supersonic turbulence, superatomic turbulence, ambipolar diffusion, anything you want to fragment the object and form stars. Keep that object there, and you have a spectrum of perturbations, wavelengths. I want to show, and I'm showing here, that the shorter wavelengths in that background, different wavelengths at that instant of time that you're seeing the typical molecular cloud, which wavelengths will survive and which are going to disappear, decay very quickly.
In other words, you're assuming that there is no wide BDF, that you start with a uniform medium, and some parts will...
In density, you mean? In density. Yeah, the density is uniform.
Okay. But if you have supersonic turbulence, the BDF will be wider.
Before you create those density contrasts, okay? That's the problem. I'm setting up a problem so that we'll understand the underlying physics. We can always go brute force numerical three-dimensional simulations and lose the forest for the trees. There is a mechanism here, okay, that decays MHD perturbations, turbulence, whatever it is, once there are weakers in the magnetic field. And I'll give you length scales in a minute, okay? I'm dealing with a time scale now. So, this is well known.
Oishi and McLow simulated turbulence with ambipolar diffusion.
Yes.
And so the effect that you're suggesting would be that the power spectrum would break below a certain scale. That it would go down.
Yes.
They looked for that effect and they actually didn't see it. And
Colin would say they should re-examine
The interpretation is things are being destroyed. The interpretation is that modes are being destroyed on small scales, but they're also constantly being pumped from larger scales.
Well, sure, they have driving. Yes, if you replenish it, let's think.
But you've got all your energies on large scale. I can destroy the small scale mode 100 times, and I've still got plenty of energy left on large scale.
I wish this issue is re-examined in a more careful way, because this specific work that keeps coming up, it's not very convincing for another reason other than the driving, and that is for this mechanism to work, you need to have self-gravity. Otherwise,
I haven't yet talked.
This
does not have self-gravity.
Let me finish. In order to get self-gravity, in order to get clumps of cores that develop, right, mm-hmm. you have to be able to allow, after this decay happens, right, you have to be able to allow it to condense. If you don't have some gravity, these waves will decay, but others will come and then nothing
exactly.
happens.
Please, Kostas is anticipating my next slide, okay? Let's move on. This is a known fact, right?
There's another point about this, and that is people who like very weak magnetic fields would put a much smaller than 30 microgauss field in there, and that would then cause that antipolar diffusion time scale to go away.
Look, the typical molecular cloud magnetic field, I mean, you have observations, right? We know.
But to be totally self-consistent, if the fields were quite weak.
This is an analytical expression, changes values to conform to whatever cloud you want to model.
Magnetic field and the ambipolar diffusion time scale would go.
That's why I normalize it to values. Anybody who wants to go and observe a particular molecular cloud.
You can make the two time scales equal with this.
That's fine. I don't have a problem. That's why it's an analytical expression. Go and use the values for any one particular cloud you want to model and understand what is happening.
The result would be that ambipolar diffusion wouldn't destroy turbulence on.
It's going to destroy us. In terms of landscapes, Any molecular cloud, and I'll address that issue in a minute, any molecular cloud has three characteristic length scales in there, as long as it's partially ionized and there is some form of a magnetic field in there. The first length scale, we call it the Alphane length scale or a cutoff length scale, and it's essentially the Alphane speed in the neutral times, the neutral ion collision time. And the physical meaning of this is that the sequences shorter than this wavelength are killed very rapidly by ambipolar diffusion. The first person who showed this was was Calzrath and Pierce in 1969 in a very different context, not the context of molecular clouds. They were interested in cosmic rays propagating the intercloud medium and exciting Alphane waves and scatter off them to isotropies, etc. And they calculated how long those waves will survive, the inhomogeneities in the magnetic field. And they had to deal with the ambipolar diffusion decay of those waves. We are using it for molecular clouds. The second critical length scale is like a Jeans length, or the radius of a Bonnot-Eber sphere. We call it the thermal critical length scale. It's essentially the adiabatic sound scale times the three-fold time. The third one is completely equivalent to the critical mass to flux ratio. We call it the magnetically critical length scale. And it's essentially the Alphane speed in the neutrals times the three-fold time scale. All right? Now let's look at the typical molecular cloud and compare the relative magnitude of these scales, because that will be very revealing. By the way, this, all of these you can find in both, some of these in the 87 review that I referred to earlier, and all of it in the 1991 APJ paper that I gave the reference. And I'll give it again if somebody wants it later on. Let's look again. I'm going to normalize this for the purpose that anybody can use his own values, okay? We'll live with whatever the physics of the problem tells us we should live with. The lambda sub a, with the magnetic field normalized to that value, little k is the exponent in the parameterization of the ion density in terms of the neutral density. So n sub I goes is proportional to a neutral to a little k power. The proportionality constant here normalized to the value of 3 times 10 to the minus 3 is this capital K in there. So that for typical values, this little k is a half. This little k is a half, so this factor will drop out. But the value of that length scale is 0.29 parsecs. Gods or devils, or both of them, must have conspired here. The Olympian gods and medieval devils probably got together. And for those typical values of molecular clouds, the thermal critical length scale is equal to that to 2 decimal place accuracy. We didn't choose these numbers. The molecular clouds choose them. I'm not going to make anything of this, but we have to keep the numbers that fall out of the equations for what they are. Nobody knows those quantities to decimal place accuracy. That's not the intent of presenting the analytical equations in this fashion. And I'll tell you what that means in a minute. The magnetic critical length scale is bigger than the other two. If the magnetic critical length scale is greater than the thermal critical length scale, the physical meaning is that the cloud is magnetically supported. If the opposite is true, it's thermally supported. If you want to put turbulence, by the way, there is a corresponding length scale for turbulence also to support a given object, and you can put it in there. We don't have a problem, all right? So do it. Extend this. I don't have a problem. Now, that's the meaning of these two in their relative magnitude. What about these two? Remember what the meaning of lambda sub a is. Wavelengths shorter than that decay very rapidly by antipolar diffusion. Now, if it so happens that this comparison, this arithmetic value here, is really real, as opposed to an accident of some numbers that may apply to only one cloud and nowhere else, that means that the self-gravity of the object in this radius, if those waves of turbulence were contributing even a small fraction to the force that opposes, or forces that oppose gravity to support this region now against its own self-gravity, if the waves of turbulence contributed even a small fraction, and suddenly ambipolar diffusion made them disappear and you haven't replenished it, what's going to happen? The gravitational field of this mass inside this region now is partially unbalanced. And back in 1987, this is the physics behind the mechanism, the suggestion I made, that it is the decay of either turbulence or MHC waves by ambipolar diffusion that initiates fragmentation in molecular clouds. Now, it's a quantitative issue of whether this is important or not, and it's the relative magnitude of those length scales. If this length scale were to be significantly greater than that, it would, the system would behave. One may think that the magnetic field is not going to be important. It is very much so. And let me go back one slide. This time scale that I showed here is not the same as the time scale for ambipolar diffusion on my first myth. That time scale referred to the drift of the neutral particles under their own self-gravity through the magnetic field lines and the attached matter, ions and electrons. This time scale over here has nothing to do with gravity. It's the decay of perturbations, but because of the driving force of the tension of the field lines, those tangled up magnetic fields, whatever you want, perturbations you want to put in there, and it's a decay of those perturbations because of the ion neutral friction. Okay? It's very different. So be careful. It's ambipolar diffusion, but perhaps you should have given it a different name to distinguish the two mechanisms. They are often confused in the literature, by the way. All right.
Okay, but if you have a distribution of densities and a distribution of magnetic
fields, you get a distribution of those length scales.
So this case will change a lot, right?
The numbers.
Numbers of this
shape. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
It's an analytical expression. Put your favorite values in there. We don't mean to project a bias here or use them in a biased way. We give them in that form so that anybody can use them, check them, reject them, whatever. We don't mind.
Why do you think that MHC perturbation not only what is our synonym? I mean, there are many types of MHC perturbation,
sure.
Not only alpha waves. And it's well known.
It's independent of the nature of the perturbation.
No, there's no compressive modes don't dissipate with that.
A shock along the magnetic field is not. It doesn't disturb the field lines. The minute you put a weaker in the magnetic field, that becomes relevant. If you want to drive all the perturbations non-linear along the magnetic field and make the assumption, which by the way is not correct, but I don't mind, that that's the only perturbation you have, fine. This will not apply. Because you are not disturbing the magnetic field. The minute you weaken the magnetic field, that's relevant. And I want to move on.
Okay,
and
what's the
punchline? Oh, I'm sorry, Mark. Go ahead.
No, what's the punchline? I was asking you to move on.
The punchline is that we use this physical mechanism to suggest back in 1987 that it is the decay of MHC waves of turbulence that initiate fragmentation. We don't dislike turbulence. We like it. The higher the contribution of turbulence or MHC waves to the initial support of the molecular cloud, the more rapid that fragmentation is going to be, because it is the imbalance between the gravitational force that tries to contract the object and the expansive or supporting forces of thermal and magnetic fields there. That imbalance is greater the greater the support due to the waves of turbulence was originally in the object. Okay? That's what I'm saying.
The original idea is that hydrodynamic turbulence would decay relatively rapidly, and that maybe if you have magnetic fields, it can organize the turbulence and cause it not to decay so rapidly. You're saying that in the presence of magnetic fields, the turbulence or MHD waves will decay even more rapidly.
The short wavelengths, you can maintain the long wavelengths for a long time.
Right, but short wavelengths decay rapidly anyway compared to long wavelengths.
That's fine. So anybody can offer an alternative if you want. I would like you to be mindful of what physics is introduced by magnetic fields in molecular clouds.
The point I'm trying to make is that the timescale, and I think Paolo made this too, the timescale for the decay of the turbulence is going to be set by the scale where you have the most energy, which observationally is the large scale. And it doesn't matter what you do to the small scales, because you'll keep pumping energy into them from larger scales. And so
it matches very much because it's the decay at the scales that I'm talking about in round numbers now, okay? 0.1 parsec or so is rapid. Then you can get fragmentation because of the decay by ambipolar diffusion as opposed to other processes.
Only if the decay on those scales is, is faster than you can pump in energy from large scales.
Absolutely.
And I don't know that you demonstrated that in your argument.
I'm not trying to. I want to make people aware of what physics is left out when they go into massive numerical simulations in a particular, with a particular set of initial conditions and leave other physical effects out that may be competing with what they are doing.
Okay. Right?
These have existed for a long time. Now let's get to the other one. Claims have been made in the literature that the simulations of turbulence reproduce the prediction I had made back in 1976, and we discussed it at some length yesterday also, meaning Bitcoin is rotated to the one half. All right? So I want to show here that this is a myth, that the turbulence simulations have not reproduced it. And in order to show that, we have to understand first what did we really predict. And then we compare it with what the turbulence simulation showed. Oh my God. All right.
How many myths are we on?
That was seven.
Oh.
We've made it more than halfway, so, you know, that's a victory. So.
There's many options. I mean, you, Chris, have talked, will be online.
Well, maybe the people don't mind staying 10 minutes later. We started later, anyhow, and finish it once and for all instead of breaking. I'm leaving, by the way, this weekend.
You get quite a bit more time already because Colin was so fascinating.
You are the boss. If you want to know what we have to say here, you're welcome.
So what Chris used to say is that when we reach the time, people now are welcome to go. Maybe we'll even thank you. And then people want to go and people want to stay. So that was the
Go for it.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. So let me first summarize what the prediction was, okay? Both analytical and numerical. The analytical combination of analytical and numerical was in the 76 paper, and the first real numerical simulation with non-ideal MHT was the one with Fiedler I referred to before. So we are plotting here the log B log rho in several units, and I showed the same three models that I showed earlier for another purpose. The numbers on each of the curve refer to the initial parent cloud mass to flux ratio relative to the critical value for collapse. A factor of 8 is a critical, not very realistic, right, according to observation, a factor of 4 and a factor of 1/2. If I wanted to plot the critical one, because we started the simulation with a uniform initial density, there is a phase, rapid phase, that flattens along the field line. So we would have seen a small horizontal line here, but then it would take off with a slope of almost 1/2 very quickly, okay, from wherever it starts. So the prediction refers, summary, the prediction refers to self-gravitating objects of any kind that are dynamically contracting, and by dynamically, I don't mean free-falling. I will say free-fall or collapse if I mean free-fall. Dynamical contraction means there is a significant acceleration, typically 20-30% of gravity up to these densities we are finding. That's the prediction. I don't know of any turbulence calculation that has compared with that. What turbulence has done, the two papers I have seen at least, do the following. They look at individual structures at a given time that already changes the previous picture, and they look at the magnetic field and the density, 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 and plot something. That's the two ideas. That excludes what Paolo was trying to do yesterday in some sense.
No, I totally agree with your statement.
Yeah, I know you would agree. This is not a criticism. I just want to distinguish.
They're very different.
Yes. So what the turbulence workers are doing, we have a prediction of that, an analytical one. With Scott Morton in 1985, in those two papers, you might want to go and shoot them down if you want. What we predicted is that after, first of all, what problem did we solve? We had waves. In that case, it was torsional waves because of the purpose of the paper, bouncing between fragments in a typical molecular cloud. And we found they could be partially reflected, partially transmitted. All those reflection transmission coefficients are included, okay? And we found that after only a few bounces, an equipartition was established between the magnetic and kinetic energy in the waves, the magnetic energy in the delta V, not the V itself, and the kinetic energy in the waves themselves. That, you can write it out immediately. Delta V squared over A pi is, forget the factor of half, I don't care, rho delta V squared, which means that the RMS magnetic field, according to that prediction, goes as density to the 1/2, but it doesn't stop there. This is a prediction. You can prove us wrong, by the way. It has the root mean square velocity here also. So my challenge to turbulent simulations, and we'll all learn from that, is do what you are doing, extend it to higher dynamic density, higher dynamic range in the density, but instead of plotting that, include this term from your simulations. I bet that the scatter of the points you're finding is going to be reduced immensely. So that comparison that some people have made in the literature with our big one is not to the 1/2, does not, it's comparing apples and oranges. And also, one second, please. I would like to finish my sentence and then I'll hear anything. And also these, the turbulence B-rho relation that you showed, really discovers part of the analytical prediction we made. Now, questions, comments, what?
I think Helena had the same question. How is it going to reduce the scatter? For a given simulation, VRMS is just a number. It's not something that's different from point to point. So how is that going to reduce the scatter?
No, remember that this refers to the...
line of sight.
Actually, it's that also, but it's because it holds more locally. You can take a smaller region, for example, and apply this also. You can do, if it holds locally, holds globally, of course, okay? But you can test it. Let's talk about it, because it's an interesting point, but let's go through. It's registered. What you said has been registered. I think it's taped also.
Okay.
So we'll talk more about it.
Okay.
But it's a well-taken point. I don't have a difficulty with that. We'll talk about it more. Number 8. This has been said so many times that I don't really know what else I can say. Somebody should start reading our figures and our papers. The prediction about molecular cloud, of course, the same three models that I showed earlier, show that all the curves, the mass-to-flux ratio, and units of the critical value for collapse, asymptote for molecular cloud holds the value between 2 and 3, no matter what initial condition we have. There is a physical reason for that, of course. Once an object exceeds the critical value, it really forgets what happened to it before, and you can. We can demonstrate it with a log V log rho curve over here. That's why I repeated it for the same model. It establishes that slope. So please don't quote us as having predicted subcritical molecular cloud course. We have been forming them and been supercritical for a very, very long time now. I don't think there is an argument on that one, right? Myth number 9. Okay, this is a relative, it's an old argument that has been revived. That the sound or other signal crossing time is actually determines, if it's not equal, at least determines the star formation time scale. And there are people who have been pushing for that very hard recently. Let's look at that in a bit more detail. Now, the sound crossing time or any other signal crossing time to be a relevant time scale for star formation means physically the following. I have an object, a cloud, taking any shape, I don't care. One point over here in the cloud, and let's say diametrically opposite point over here, must be able to communicate with that appropriate signal speed, whatever it is, sound speed, turbulent root mean square velocity, Alphane speed, it doesn't matter, so that this blob of matter is not a blob yet. This region of the cloud here and this region of the cloud here would know what each other is doing and to behave in concert. If star formation were or is a coherent process, that would be fine. But if this part of the cloud can form stars independently of this part of the cloud, the signal crossing time is irrelevant. This is the theoretical argument. And there is actually both a counterexample, both theoretical and actual observational counterexample to this. You may have seen Bruce L. McGreen's, for example, figure of the star formation timescale against the closing time. All objects fall on that, from sub-parsec scales and molecular cloud cores to galaxies and clusters and whatever. Everything falls up there. Okay? So the bigger the object, the longer the star formation timescale because of that crossing time that restricts this argument. If that's the case, then what happened to genes? Genes show to us that if I consider an object, say, typical molecular cloud density 10 to the 4 particles per cubic centimeter, this is a thought experiment, it's not a real molecular cloud now, right? And the object is very extended. I can take it to be infinite. By that argument, it should take an infinite amount of time to form stars. Well, genes knew the answer. That's not true. The object will fragment and form stars on the freefall time scale. And somebody may say, oh, that's a theoretical example. I don't care. I'm an observer. Actually, somebody told me that. It's not here. There are objects like that. They are called starburst galaxies. The mean density is 10 to the 4 particles per cubic centimeter. And they don't wait for a very long time to form stars. They form it dynamically. So there are counterexamples to that.
I think Bruce's argument is wrong, but I also think you're misinterpreting it. Bruce doesn't mean that there's a delay in the onset of star formation of a crossing time. What he means is that the duration of star formation from start to end is a crossing time, and he would argue that's because in one crossing time you destroy the star forming cloud or you'll consume all its gas, one of those two.
Well, I let Bruce speak for himself. I met him in about a month ago.
There's a delay in the onset of star formation. That's very
it's
different.
Possible. I talked with Bruce at Zurich. That workshop for extragalactic numerical simulations, etc. And I didn't hear that from him, but maybe that's what he means, and we have to readdress it.
Okay.
I'll communicate with him again and see what we can do.
But I'm sorry, is that true with you that you need a coherence, though? Because if you have
I'm not suggesting coherence.
No. In order to justify the crossing time.
That's what it means.
Because if you have an established field of density that depends on mean density and Mach number, then you really have, you could imagine that even if you don't speak to each other, you know already the rate at which star has to be formed locally because the PDF is established and depends on those two points that you can use to build the crossing time or the fall time.
Anybody who would like to address the issue in any form is welcome to do it. I have no problem. I'm raising the issue and pointing out the weaknesses on those things. Okay? If somebody would like to think and calculate of why the crossing time due to any signal will be a relevant star formation in the corrected or original sense that I stated or as corrected by Mark, that's fine. Okay, let's do it. Let's discuss it even further. Sorry, Mark.
Yeah, I'd say for an observed molecular cloud, the freefall time and the crossing time are about the same. So if you think that the freefall time is relevant, therefore the crossing time is relevant.
Correct. I don't think the freefall time, by the way, is relevant, but we can take that position. It's not one of my myths here.
Okay.
I'm giving you some codes here because it's been coded in the literature. There have been statements in the literature that we don't essentially include or ignore turbulence, and that's why you get what you do, etc. So long before these numerical simulations that are flourishing all over the place now, we used, as I already explained, the decay of hydromagnetic waves or turbulence to really initiate fragmentation, star formation in molecular clouds. And I'm giving you the two codes here. This is from the 87 paper. There is a subsection of what selects a one solar mass object in there, and this is from the 96 review that I had given. Let me read this, and I'll let you read it on your own. After all, I think this will be on the web anyhow. This is what it says. Magnetic support can include a contribution for hydromagnetic waves. In fact, it was suggested that it is precisely the damping of hydromagnetic waves by antipolar diffusion in magnetically supported clouds rather than the growth of perturbations in collapsing clouds that initiates fragmentation and star formation. We could be wrong, but we are stuck with it. And we did not ignore MHD waves or turbulence in what we are doing. Myth number 11, we are getting there. This has to do with the fact that The argument was made first observationally, and I think by W.W. Roberts in the late 60s also, that one sees the inner edge of a spiral density shockwave or a galactic shock, but sees the OB star significantly downstream from a galactic shock, and the timescale that was given originally is that there is a delay of about 3×10⁷ years between the first appearance of the dense matter and we now know CO molecules and the formation of the appearance of OB stars. And recently there have been arguments that that is not really so, that there isn't such a delay. And I would like to address it a little bit, but be careful. Let's be careful here. I'm talking about massive stars. I'm talking about normal stars. I have a different kind of story later on. Okay? What did we say? We said about, what did we say about that? One has to compare the peak of the H alpha emission with the first appearance of molecular clouds, not the peak of CO and the peak of H alpha. Why? Because if you have molecular clouds, if you form OB stars in a molecular cloud, by definition, the density must have increased sufficiently to form stars. That means you are in a high density region unless the OB stars that form had enough time, and it's not very long, to influence the environment, expand it, reduce the density, but then you probably should see the shock related to the expansion of the H2 region. But if you wait long enough, you may see nothing. Okay? So, but the spiral galaxies seen face on are very beautiful because the spatial distribution in the direction of the velocity of gas entering the spiral arm and leaving it on the other side can be translated into a temporal distribution. And that's, that can tell us a lot. So we noted that difference and we said it appears that star formation, the bulk of the OB star formation is delayed, massive star formation, right, is delayed relative to the appearance, first appearance of molecules. And people criticize that for us. So let's look at M51 from Scoville and others, 2001. And this is not our argument, other people have made it, I'm just showing it here. Maybe if we darken it, because from where I'm sitting, I don't see what I want to demonstrate.
Yeah, the problem is the door, not so much the light, unfortunately.
Oh. It's unfortunate, because it really...
Well, that should be better.
That's as dark as it gets.
Yeah, that's it.
All right, I think I may be able to do it. Okay. What I want to say, this is H-alpha in red superimposed over the optical, and there are dots here of massive star formation. The material enters this way almost as immutably, that seem to be delayed, and there is a red dot here, actually, at the front edge of the galactic shock. So we never said, and we are not saying, and we never will say, that all stars have to form with a certain delay. And I'll return to that, okay? But there are, the bulk of the OB stars seem to be displaced from the inner edge. There is almost a W here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 knots of H alpha there that form the form, I cannot talk. The 5 points are at the corners of the W, and there is this delay both in the northern and southern arms. And one may say, though, and was said, well, yeah, but here we have a lot of obscuration in the task lane, and probably there are H2 regions there that we really cannot see. It's fair enough. But Scoville and his collaborators are very bright observers, so they didn't stop at that observation. They also observed the passion alpha line. And that one, we cannot obscure very easily. Not for typical task lanes of spiral galaxies. And I wish I could flip back and forth on the same scale to show you what happened, but if you look at the passion alpha that I showed in a minute, both for that region, choose any other region, this one, if the H2 regions were obscure, because passion alpha will look at the star directly and there's very little obscuration for that, there is some, but by no means that much, then we should see, you know, quite a few new dots now that we show in the red color in the next transparency. We don't. The passion alpha and the H alpha knots that I'm referring to coincide they are where the knots that I pointed out over here and the others, they are a little lower because of the bigger scale. The W is still here, and you won't really see. That doesn't mean there is no red, new red dot somewhere here. There is star formation that takes place earlier, at that big delay of 3 times 10^7 years. But the bulk of the OB stars, the massive stars, are delayed.
Is it consistent with sprinkling them randomly in the dust? No, it's not.
Observers will not agree with you on that. So what did? What about the Loma stars there? This is not something that I can debate. I'm stuck with a prediction I made in 1978, and I'm quoting from that paper over here. The extreme non-homology introduced by the magnetic field, this is the conclusion, also implies that Loma stars should form, should preferentially form first and perhaps only in the core of a dense cloud. In 1981, Verba, Coyne, and Tapia quoted this paper because they saw that effect, they claimed at least, and then they had a second paper a few years later, and I think now there is a renewed interest now as to the which stars form first, low mass or massive, and where they form the clouds, so I thought of mentioning this in here. 12, it was taught both at meetings and in papers that we only the antipolar diffusion theory of star formation is relevant only to low mass cores and stars. Okay? That is not true. In 1987, I gave this diagram with a different title. It was taught, it was called a scenario for star formation that begins with a mechanism for ISC interstellar cloud formation, and look at the products, and then I'll explain a couple more details. We have closed binaries, intermediate and low mass stars, and Sun Jupiter binaries on one branch, which I have called subaffinity collapse. Collapse was defined in this paper. I wish I had used a different name, but it's explicitly defined to mean indefinite contraction, but not free fall. Okay? So collapse is not a free fall here. And I have a second branch here that is superalphenic. And the difference between the subalphenic and the superalphenic collapse on the basis of simple analytical estimates at time was that look at what the most common object that is formed here are the massive stars and white binaries. There is a possibility if one follows a different path from the subalphenic collapse to get some white binaries and some massive stars, but that's secondary.
Actually, I should mention, almost all massive stars are close binaries.
That's fine.
Okay, just you have massive single stars.
No, that's fine. It's really the argument that led to the separation of those two has to do with how much angular momentum you have in your binary system. By closed binaries, I mean either the spectroscopic pairs, as observers would call them, as opposed to the wide visual pairs.
Most massive stars are spectroscopic binaries.
Then those could form. Those could form. But it was, and we have been filling the steps, basically. You increase the density as you go down here, obviously. And notice something that I think will be of interest to this audience because the issue came up in different contexts so far. This line here was not there in the original diagram, neither was this red. I put them now as well as reference, okay? I put it here to remind me to point out something. Look what is happening here. Molecule formation, fragmentation, and either external forces, F external or internal of the polar diffusion, were thought at the time and expressed it in the paper as the sources that will lead to fragmentation essentially at the same time that you form molecules. So we have not advocated, in fact this is 20 years old, that you form molecules and you wait for an enormous amount of time for something for fragmentation to happen. It's there, exactly why. It's an idea. If I meant fragmentation to take place here, I would have said it and put it there. It's essentially at the same density, and there were reasons for that. Right? And finally, this is mostly for the people who have an interest in extragalactic astrophysics rather than the star formation we are talking about now. The usual assumption that cosmic rays and magnetic fields are in energy equipartition is not actually correct. The reason is that, let's give an observational argument first. Suppose it were correct that there is energy repartition between the cosmic rays and the magnetic fields. Then if you look in the interarm region of the galaxies in phase on, you see a certain emissivity, intensity, whatever unit you want to use, of synchronous radiation. If you go from the interarm to the arm region with your telescope beam, you should see an enhancement in that emission for two reasons. The first one is you compress the magnetic field, and the synchrotron emissivity goes almost as B squared, 1.8 power, really. And you also compress the cosmic rays, the electrons, the relativistic electrons. So you get another factor of 10 from there. So you should expect an increase, because the density increase from the interarm to the arm region is typically 10, you should see an enhancement by almost a factor of 1,000. The enhancement is almost by a factor of 4, not a factor of 1,000. Also, if you move your radio beam along spiral arm, because of the compression of magnetic field lines, if you know that there are giant H2 region, giant cloud complexes, H2 regions, and OB stars appear to be like beads on a string along spiral arms. So the magnetic field is stronger in those regions as opposed to the in-between. You should see also a significant variation in the synchrotron emissivity or intensity as you move the radio beam along spiral arm. You don't see that. It's negligible. This is, by the way, this is an old number. I checked to see if I can find a more recent one. That probably nobody argued against it, and it's still valid, but you don't see factor of 2 in there. So what's the explanation? The explanation is that if we are right, as we said back in 1974 in two papers, one with Sher Woodward and the other by myself, on the Parker instability, the compression that occurs as the gas goes from the interarm to the arm region triggers the Parker instability, changes the physical parameters of the gas in such a way that an originally stable phase becomes Parker unstable in a spiral arm. If that happens, the field lines buckle up, form valleys and mountains, and the vertical component of the galactic gravitational field then acts along the field line and drains the matter down into valleys of the field lines where the magnetic field is strongest. Now, if cosmic rays if the density of cosmic rays were to be greater where the magnetic field is stronger, that would imply that you would have a big density, a pressure gradient between the valleys of the field lines and where the magnetic field is weak, cosmic ray pressure gradient. But cosmic rays are a relativistic gas. They don't like to have that kind of pressure gradient because the only force available to maintain it along the field lines is gravity, and gravity doesn't act on them. So they will equalize their pressure along the field lines. But if you think about it for a relativistic gas, the pressure goes as the density to the fourth third powers. That means you will find a uniform density in each flux tube along each field line. So where the magnetic field is strongest, you find a smaller, there is an anti-correlation between the strength of the magnetic field and the density of cosmic rays at a given height in the galaxy, because the flux tubes bend upward. So it is incorrect to be assuming equipartition. And this explains why we don't see the 1,000-factor enhancement as you go from the interarm to the arm region for synchrotron radiation, and also you don't see it along spiral arms because of this anti-correlation between them. And I think, I cannot talk here to this audience without mentioning angular momentum, no means here. Both analytically with Paleolau in 1979 and 1980, we addressed the magnetic braking problem both for aligned and perpendicular rotators, and numerically the first time with Bazou in 1994. And I plotted here the numerical result, the specific angular momentum, the initial as a function of mass of the model cloud that we are using. The initial state here had this linear distribution, but it can start horizontal and it doesn't matter. Magnetic braking very quickly changes whatever initial conditions you put it into these curves. Time goes downward here in the curve. Initial state, final state is the solid line there. That means the central density of the model cloud has increased by 6 orders of magnitude as compared to the initial state that was 3 times 10 to the 3 particles per cubic centimeter and we got to 10 to the 9. And the reason I want to show this is something that we were not planning. Go to one solar mass and go and read what specific angular momentum that corresponds. 10 to the 19 is CGS unit. That's exactly what solar and planetary physicists tell us was the specific angular momentum to the best ability to determine it for the protosolar nebula. And I'll say my conclusions for you. Magnetic fields have been shown to play a crucial role in, I cannot talk, forgive me, I'm a little tired, in present-day star formation. I know some of you do disagree with that. We believe we showed it. Prove us wrong. Observations are in excellent quantitative agreement with the ambiform diffusion theory. We have made more than probably 3 dozen predictions, and many of them have been confirmed by observations. But to me, the most important thing is that we have not yet found a single observation that will contradict us. That doesn't mean it will not happen. I hope it happens because it will make us to rethink what we are doing. That's how progress in science is made. We won't be offended by that. But for the moment, that is correct. Magnetic braking resolves the angular momentum problem of star formation, and we can transfer the knowledge we acquire for the 6-fluid system of equations we are solving, non-ideal MHD, including all the chemistry of grains. We can transfer it to primordial star formation, which is actually easier because it doesn't have grains, except that there are more uncertainties, of course, there. Dalmatian and Kapala are being relevant. Now, interestingly enough, in 1989, I gave the conclusion in one or two sentences in a review for the Zermatt meeting on, I don't remember what the subject was, interstellar clouds, something there. And the conclusion of an analytical calculation was that the first stars that we form, primordial now star formation, should be massive. On the basis, by the way, of the same length scales that I had given and time scales that I had given early on that we had some discussion. And this should be of interest, I think, to this class. There, a caution, we have seen that whenever we have two quantity correlations, whether it's the line width and size, luminosity of galaxies and mass, luminosity of galaxies and dispersion velocity, is dangerous because we can get a correlation with a significant spread. But if we really look at the underlying physics, there may be another quantity hidden there. In the case I showed was the magnetic field, and then the spread basically disappeared. Well, it doesn't disappear, it becomes smaller. So we have to be thinking of the background physics rather than plugging one quantity against another. Now, I made a comment about primordial star formation, but what is the magnetic field? If the magnetic field at a given density of a primordial molecular cloud were to be comparable in magnitude with the magnetic field we see today, I understand what is going to happen. The first stars will be the massive stars. If it's different, I don't have a clue. I have to really rethink the issue.
What do you assume is a molecular cloud?
I'm sorry, what?
There's actually in primordial galaxies, you actually don't make molecular clouds in the way you think about it.
No, it's not the way I think about it. By any means, Salkinen and others have addressed that issue of Mike Schur, right? Of how molecules will form. That's the picture I'm referring to now, not our picture. No. Nothing we have done today ourselves addresses the issue of molecular cloud formation in the early universe. Thank you for pointing it out. My God, I don't mean to say that. Okay, so I haven't said anything about the IMF, and there is a reason for that. First, we haven't calculated. Why not? Because the way I'm trying to understand star formation, there are many ways, useful ways, equally useful perhaps, that somebody can try, is that I really try to understand the physical processes, the physics of and chemistry of star formation for one object. If I understand it for that, then I can do it for many and distribution of masses and whatnot. If I cannot do it for that, even if I know what the IMF is from statistical or other arguments, I still, other people might, I still cannot claim that I understood star formation. I really want to know the physics that takes me, certainly from molecular cloud densities, to 10 to the 20 or so particles per cubic centimeter, so that I can start burning deuterium and I say, you know what, I think I understand it now, I can do something else useful in my life. But until I do that, I'm not going to go into the into other aspects of the star formation process. I want to know the physics that goes on there. And very quick, few second movie on the basis of the calculations we did with Hitler in 1992-93. I cannot stop it, unfortunately, because it's a GIF. Okay. The black lines are obviously magnetic field lines. Deep show some of these pictures. The oblate contours are isodensity contours. The velocity vectors, I think the longest one is 0.5 kilometers per second of the infall. You can see that the infall is more rapid along the field lines as opposed to perpendicular to field lines, because perpendicular, although the field lines should be formed, you can see that once the object becomes dynamical, although not free-falling, the magnetic flux is almost frozen in the matter in the innermost part of the model cloud, and you can see the deformation of the field line. But those of you working with turbulence here might be interested in something. I wish it were significant, and I could claim that, but I cannot. Look at the field lines. They weaken and they shape. That's not the numerical effect. There are perturbations that propagate. Unfortunately, they are small amplitude. They cannot explain the line widths or anything else, but there are perturbations that are propagating. So after the star forms, so that you do not think that I completely disagree with Turbulence statements and calculations, numerical or other, after the star forms, if it produces additional perturbation, it could conceivably introduce higher amplitude disturbances in the field lines, in which case it would be nonlinear waves, and then one would see whether they can explain line widths or whatever, but we haven't done that. I'm not claiming that we have done that. And I think, thank you for your patience. And I don't know if there is time for questions, so we'll take them later. Tom, what should we do? Oh, I don't know. Can we give